This is On Science, the weekly podcast from the Science Desk at NPR News. I'm Stephanie Federico. This week on the podcast, we'll hear about the struggle to fight back rising sea levels, the challenges Europe still faces 25 years after Chernobyl. We'll also hear about research that supports the tough call aviation officials made last April. That's when they grounded planes after a volcano erupted in Iceland. And finally, combating the stink bug plague. But first, solving the mystery of how humpback whales swim such amazingly straight lines. Each year, humpback whales migrate thousands of miles across vast expanses of open ocean. Scientists are now learning more about their long-distance journeys with the help of new tracking technologies. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce explains the mystery of how whales can chart such a steady course.
Biologists have been tagging humpback whales off Brazil for years to follow their seasonal migrations to the Antarctic. They've published maps of the whales' routes, and recently, an environmental scientist named Travis Horton saw these maps and thought, wow, lots of the time, they're going straight as an arrow.
They're out there in the open ocean with its sea surface currents, with its storm events, et cetera, et cetera, and they're able over 28 days to maintain a near-perfect straight line over 2,200 kilometers of distance. It's just absolutely remarkable how straight these courses are.
Horton works in New Zealand at the University of Canterbury. He studies how animals navigate, and he says if you were out in the ocean in a rowboat and tried to keep a straight course, it would be hard. There's no landmarks, just water, water, and more water. He asked himself, if I were a humpback whale,
what's available to me? What could I possibly be using to orientate so precisely by?
Decades of experiments on other migrating animals, like birds, suggested two possibilities. The whales might be using the position of the sun or the Earth's magnetic field. Horton tested those ideas by analyzing both in relation to the whales' paths, but no dice.
What we found is that the two leading theories of animal orientation don't necessarily work all that well for humpback whales.
He thinks it is possible that the whales might be using a combination of the two strategies, although that's just a theory. He and his colleagues have published their finding in the British journal Biology Letters.
Oh, the paper is actually very interesting.
Patrick Robinson is a biologist at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He says not many people study navigation in marine mammals.
Most of the work has been done on birds and other terrestrial animals.
And a lot of that work has been artificial experiments, not studies of creatures out in the wild. Robinson wasn't entirely surprised by the whale's abilities. He's recently been tracking the long migrations of northern elephant seals that travel from California out into the middle of the North Pacific. It takes the seals several weeks.
And what's interesting is that we do have animals traveling in near perfect straight lines, meaning a navigationally perfect straight line, a great circle route, which is different than simply following a straight compass bearing.
He says ocean dwellers are clearly expert navigators, and it will take a lot of scientific expertise to figure out how they do it. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
Some of the nation's richest and most important ecosystems lie where the ocean meets the land. Those same coastal areas will disappear if the sea level continues rising as a result of climate change. Now, scientists and managers at a wildlife refuge in North Carolina are attempting to fight back the sea. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
The Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge encompasses 154,000 acres of marshland and a rare type of lowland forest called Pocosin. It's just about the only place on Earth where the endangered red wolf still roams, and a lot of it is at or near sea level, which means it's in big trouble as the sea rises. But with the unbounded optimism of youth, a dozen or so college students arrived one spring day to see what they could do. Jamie Rowan from the University of North Carolina at Greensboro is raking oyster shells into mesh bags, which will be used to build a reef off a nearby coastline. This music major, studying classical guitar, likes the change of pace.
My teacher told me to rest my hands this week. That's definitely not happening.
Yeah, really.
His classmate, Elizabeth Livingston, happily labors nearby on her spring break.
I feel like you'll remember this over, partying at the beach or something.
The bags they're filling and then stacking on wooden pallets are enough to build just a few hundred feet of reef to slow erosion along a coastline that stretches hundreds of miles. So you might ask whether these students are tilting at windmills. After all, the sea has been encroaching here for decades. Just ask Winky Silver. His family home on the nearby Outer Banks has been moved 6 times. And as he watches the students raking shells, he tells a story he heard from another of the old-timers around here.
He said his grandmother could walk from Roanoke Island to the Dare County mainland by rail, which meant not a railroad train, but a rail fence post that she would put from clump to clump and go and cross over. Whether that's rocking chair history or geographic history, I don't know. But I do know that that was, if you look back at the old maps, that was a marsh all the way across.
Silver knows that the pond pines that are characteristic of the Pocosin coastal forest are also losing ground to the ocean.
The stumps out there in the shallow water, you can tell, you know, if you bring a boat in there and tear your boat up, you know that once that was tree line and land.
Silver wears a homemade visor to keep the sun off his ears. He's been hired to use his barges to build the reef out of these bags of shells. And though the work has been taking place on a federal wildlife refuge, the effort is actually being led by a scientist from the Nature Conservancy, Brian Booten.
See you later, Wakey.
Booten starts out in his pickup truck toward Point Peter, where the reef is being built. On the way, he explains that the reef is just one part of a larger plan to preserve the refuge. We pull over along the side of a gravel road to see another element of the plan. The eager young biologist slips on his rubber boots and heads off into a wide expanse of marsh. Water comes up the sides of our shoes. You can't get any closer to sea level than this. About 100 yards off the road, he proudly points to a bare twig coming out of the sodden soil. It's a freshly planted cypress tree.
Here's one of our cypress. Right now, not quite leafed out.
Like the college students, this twig of a tree also seems to radiate hopefulness.
Once these leaf out this spring here, we'll have a nice lime green veneer across the top of all this marsh grass out here. So it'll be pretty evident how many cypress are in this area.
The experiment is designed to see whether the 20,000 very tolerant trees they've planted can help create a forest here, which is home to the red wolf, black bear, bobcats, and other animals whose habitat is gradually disappearing. Of course, if the sea keeps rising, these trees could simply find themselves drowned in salt water. Booten has been thinking about that a lot. Soon after we return to the road, we come across a refuge construction crew installing a new culvert. And surprisingly, the goal of this project is to bring more water into the marsh where the trees are growing. Booten explains that the hope is this fresh water will build up organic soil here by encouraging the plants that produce it.
Part of the soil conditions that those species need to really be happy and healthy is to have a damp soil.
So you want to bring the water onto the landscape. That it seems counterintuitive if you're trying to stave off sea level rise.
Well, not if you're a wetland and you need to be wet.
So how quickly can these soils build up?
Well, they're not very fast. You're looking at a couple of millimeters a year.
Unfortunately, sea level is rising at the rate of 3 or 4 millimeters a year here, and forecast to rise faster.
We're not quite keeping up with sea level rise, and I think that's going to be something that is the case pretty much everywhere that we work with in Pamlico Sound. But the idea is to reduce the rate of loss.
Losing the battle, but losing it slowly, makes perfect sense to Mike Bryant. He runs this refuge for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
We expect change from sea level rise as a consequence of the warming and the melting of ice. And as that sea level rises, we expect to lose land.
When you look down the road, is this refuge doomed?
I don't know if it's doomed, but I certainly think it's shrinking.
Eventually, the maps of this area show this refuge will be almost entirely submerged once sea level rises 4 feet, which could be within a lifetime. But he says simply that change is inevitable on planet Earth. So what he can do is help the ecosystems adapt with some grace.
I don't think we can put a dike around a 150,000-acre refuge and pump it out. So I think we just have to adapt that landscape to the change.
That means fighting back the tide in the short run, but it also means thinking ahead.
We'd like to think about where is the next best place for wildlife on higher ground, how do we have wildlife corridors between Alligator River Refuge and those lands? And then how do we secure some of those lands that are on higher ground for wildlife in the future?
While Bryant starts the delicate task of acquiring new land, Booten is trying to buy time. When we arrive at Point Peter, a gale is blowing up between us and the Outer Banks off to the east. These churning whitecaps are eating away parts of Point Peter at the rate of up to 30 feet a year, he says. But then he points to some white pipes sticking out of the water to our left. That's where Winky Silver has been stacking those bags of oyster shells out in the water. And Booten says the marsh behind that reef is eroding at a much slower rate. But he knows he can't protect very much of this coast with labor-intensive reefs.
We are focusing on finding those areas that are most vulnerable right now and that are most in need of having their shoreline erosion addressed.
It's not a permanent solution, but in the process they are learning what works and what doesn't work in their struggle to fight back the sea. Richard Harris, NPR News.
New research sheds light on a tough call aviation officials had to make last April when a volcano erupted in Iceland. Wind blew a cloud of volcanic ash towards Europe, and ash particles can be hazardous to jet aircraft. Authorities had to decide whether to ground planes and inconvenience tens of thousands of travelers, or let the planes fly and risk an accident. They decided to ground the planes, and as NPR's Joe Palko reports, it now appears that was a good call.
The Icelandic eruption was a pain in the neck for a lot of people. One of them was Susan Stipp. She's a professor of nanotechnology at the University of Copenhagen. She had colleagues that needed to get home to Denmark and others who were waiting to leave.
And I had some samples that needed to come from Scotland and get processed in Denmark.
Stipp wondered if officials had made the right decision to close the airspace over Europe. And since she studies tiny particles like the ones in volcanic ash, she was in a position to find out.
So I phoned up my friend and colleague, Siggi Gislason, in Iceland, and we agreed to get some ash and see if we could do something.
Gislason and some of his colleagues drove from Reykjavik to the foot of the volcano, collected some ash, and when planes started flying again, they sent the samples to Stipp in Denmark, where she analyzed them. One thing became clear at once.
They made exactly the right decision.
To close the airspace, that is. Stipp says her analysis shows there were several reasons the ash particles from the Iceland volcano were so dangerous. First, they were particularly fine-grained.
And those fine particles are extremely sharp compared to typical ash, which is usually somewhat more rounded.
They were also extremely hard.
And the sharpness and the hardness makes them abrasive for airplane wings and bodies and windows.
The abrasion can make it impossible to see out the cockpit window. Finally, the fact they were small posed a particular threat to jet engines.
If they're tiny particles, then they melt quickly, and then they condense on the cooler engine parts and cause them to fail.
Stipp's research appears in the current issue of the journal PNAS. Obviously, in this case, her research came after decisions about air travel had been made. But Stipp says this kind of analysis could help authorities make informed decisions the next time a plume of ash intersects a busy airline travel corridor. Joe Palka, NPR News.
The accident at Chernobyl changed the lives of many people in Ukraine, but it did more than that. It put a radioactive stain on many parts of Europe, showing how far-reaching a serious nuclear accident could be. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports on the costs that are still coming due a quarter century later.
On those late April days in 1986, plumes of radioactive smoke spread for thousands of square miles across Ukraine, the former Soviet Union, Europe, Scandinavia. Beyond 20 miles or so from the reactor, the doses did not pose an immediate health threat. But what about long-term effects of low-level exposures? Calculations say the accident has and will cause thousands of cancer deaths. But so many people get cancer, it's hard to tease out the extra ones caused by Chernobyl. Radiologist Fred Mettler has been trying to do that with a special United Nations radiation group.
You would have 20 million people over that time dying of cancer generally. And now you're trying to find 4,000 extra cases or 10,000 extra cases. That signal is pretty much too small to actually be able to see.
To really isolate cancers caused by Chernobyl, Mettler says scientists need to know patient histories. Did they smoke, drink heavily, have cancer in the family?
Unfortunately, most of these countries are not sharing their data on health effects back and forth.
Mettler says the easiest Chernobyl cancers to detect are thyroid cancers. Normally, they're rare and are known to be caused by radioactive iodine, of which there was plenty floating around after the accident. Mettler says about 7,000 people got thyroid cancer from the radiation. The vast majority of these have been cured, but there will be more cases. How many more is a mystery.
Because we know it went up in those that were exposed as children, the public and so forth. And it's gone up. We don't know whether that risk is going to go down over time or keep going up or level off. That's probably the biggest thing that's going to be studied and focused on.
Mettler and other scientists say the residents who've moved back, as well as the hundreds of thousands of so-called liquidators who returned to clean up the site, are a potential gold mine of information. They are the only large population of people exposed to low levels of radiation since the Japanese survivors at Nagasaki and Hiroshima. But finding them, their medical records, or the money to do the research is doubtful. What worries some health professionals more than radiation are the psychological effects of the accident. James Smith is a physicist at the University of Southampton who has studied Chernobyl for two decades. He says several studies found high rates of suicide, depression, and mental health problems in the region after Chernobyl.
Having to live with radiation, knowing that you've been exposed, gives an additional psychological stress because the information hasn't always been reliable, so people don't always know what the risk to their health really is.
And Smith says Chernobyl remains an open sore for Ukraine. The government is trying to raise hundreds of millions of dollars to construct a huge building that will cover the crumbling concrete sarcophagus that now keeps the highly radioactive plant isolated. And then there's the radiation that's still locked up in the environment, largely out of sight but potentially dangerous. For example, there's lots of long-lasting cesium bound up in the forests and soil around the plant. Chad Oliver is a forestry professor at Yale University who's been there.
The forests have been crowded and untended, and they're on soils and in a climate that they could very well go up in a catastrophic fire similar to our Western fires. The problem with the catastrophic fires is that they even create their own weather patterns, so you get some very tremendous dispersion of smoke.
The radioactive smoke might not be deadly as far as the city of Kiev, about 100 miles away, but the local effects could be very dangerous.
The worst concern is the firefighters that are going in there would be inhaling that close. It would be quite concentrated radioactive smoke.
Oliver says the firefighting equipment near the site is outdated and the roads are poor. Recently, though, the U.S. Forest Service has been pitching in. Teams from the service are advising Ukraine on how to cull trees and remove downed wood to lower the fire hazard. They're also studying wind and weather patterns in case another conflagration hits Chernobyl. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Now we have the latest coverage on a plague of stink bugs. Stink bugs look like brown shields with legs. They are native to Asia, but showed up in the United States in the mid-Atlantic region in the 1990s, and they have now spread to 30 states. But as Sabri Benashour from member station WAMU reports, help may be on the way.
By now, it almost seems like everyone in the mid-Atlantic knows these invaders.
They're everywhere in the house.
In the couch and clothing.
The brown, marmorated stink bug.
During the daytime when it's warm, they all come. You know, it was all black, all my walls.
That's Marianne Burkhart, Charles Black, and Fabi Meradian. If you try to crush a stink bug, it gives off a smell like cilantro and burning rubber. Pretty annoying in your home, but for farmers like Bob Black, it's about money.
This thing is really going to put a big chapter in my book of life. I've never had anything affect me like this.
Black is out checking his stink bug traps at his orchard in Thurmont, Maryland. Like a lot of mid-Atlantic farmers, he's seen some of his crops decimated by marmorated stink bugs. They take their long, needle-like mouthpiece and stick it into the flesh of fruits and vegetables, leaving them bruised and disfigured.
One of my late varieties, Pink Lady, which a lot of people like, we had up to 50% damage on that. I can handle a few percent, but, you know, it gets up to 25 to 50%. That's pretty devastating for me.
And this year, we'll probably be worse. Mike Raup is an entomologist at the University of Maryland.
We're going to hear a collective wail up and down the East Coast as hordes of these things come out of people's attics and try to find their way back outdoors.
He says the problem is pretty basic.
When they escaped Asia, they simply arrived here without their natural enemies.
A natural enemy. Well, that's exactly what a U.S. Department of Agriculture insect lab has in Newark, Delaware. Outside a red door marked quarantine, entomologist Kim Homer is suiting up and taking me down a series of dark, glowing red corridors.
See that all the light is red to minimize insect flight movement, because most insects can't see red. This looks like a dark room to them.
Homer takes out tray after tray of vials and petri dishes. Inside, rafts of tiny, pearly green orbs sit on leaves. They're stink bug eggs.
This is a typical example of a fresh, brown marmorated stink bug egg mass, and we're exposing them to female Trisulcus wasps.
Is that what's crawling around
in
there right now?
Crawling around in the vial right now.
Parasitoid Trisulcus wasps from China, Japan, and Korea. Just 2 millimeters long, they don't look like much more than gnats. They don't bite or sting. But Homer tells me that in Asia, they are the mortal nemesis of the brown marmorated stink bug.
These small wasps will deposit their eggs inside the stink bug eggs. And then the parasite egg hatches, and its immature stage feeds on the inside of the stink bug egg.
In a few weeks, out pops a new wasp and no stink bug. Homer says these wasps are extremely specialized.
If they can't find stink bug eggs to lay their own eggs in, they'll die. They can't survive on anything else.
But there are almost 300 types of stink bugs in the U.S., and a lot of them are helpful because they eat other pests. So Homer needs to know, would these wasps ever go after them?
If they won't attack any of the close relatives, they will not be as likely to attack any of the more distant ones.
Using one species to control another actually can work, but there have also been some spectacular failures. That's why Homer will spend 3 more years studying these wasps before he's satisfied they won't solve one problem but cause another. For NPR News, I'm Sabri Benishor in Washington, D.C.
And that's all for this edition of On Science. Thanks for listening. I'm Stephanie Federico.